explosive.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk. Think about this. About a year ago, when folks were saying, if Donald Trump gets elected, and people were skeptical of that about a year ago, I said, they said, well, how are they going to get rid of all these illegal aliens? How will Donald Trump do it? I said, well, number one, he's going to do it through the biggest deportation that America's ever seen. The courts have largely gotten in the way of that. But the second method, which did not get talked about as much, we talked about it on this program, was self-deportation. I want to give you one great example that just popped up this week. It involves an illegal who's been here for 10 years. He has managed to break the law in America, get caught by the police, and end up with $100,000 in his pocket. And I'll tell you about that as well. But let me get to all that in just a moment. First, welcome to the program. We call it the best conversation in talk journalism. You're certainly welcome to join anytime you want at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we will put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And I want you to carefully consider our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question from the news of the day every day, and you'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Should Northwest Utilities ask their customers to voluntarily not use electricity to avoid blackouts? Now, you say, why are you asking this? I've been hearing from customers of PSE today. PSE is Puget Sound Energy. And what does Puget Sound Energy sell? They sell natural gas. They also sell electricity. But what are they doing today? One of my emailers, and I'll give you the full email a bit later, but he wrote to me, he said he couldn't believe it. He drives a gasoline-powered car. He has a house that is dependent mostly on natural gas, only a little bit on electricity, and he gets a phone call from PSE. And he tells me, I've not been able to find out from PSE's website or from the company itself, but we know these flex events have happened before. And if you don't know what the flex is the power company saying, we've been encouraging people to buy electric cars. We've been encouraging people, even giving people cash incentives to switch from good, clean, cheap, and available natural gas over to electricity for their home heat, for their water heat, for all the other needs they have. We want you to switch over to electricity from natural gas. But what are they asking folks to do now? They understand the temperatures are high in the Pacific Northwest, and that means they're going to be running short of power. Now, fact is, the power companies have been somewhat complicit in what the state governments of Oregon and Washington, less so in Idaho, but Oregon and Washington have been pushing hard. Get away from natural gas. Get away from anything. Go to electricity. Buy an electric car. Switch your entire house over to electricity. Give up on that natural gas, even though it is clean, safe, and available. And America has at least 100 years' supply of natural gas, and we're still finding more. Now, it doesn't sound like sensible approach to the problem to me. And what the utility companies have been doing at the same time is they've been abandoning coal-fired power. Boardman Coal Plant out in eastern Oregon, Centralia in Washington State, and coal-fired electricity from all over the region that feeds into Oregon and Washington. And if you say, well, if they're encouraging people to use more electricity and cutting themselves off from known and reliable sources of electricity, they're going to run short. That's right. They are. So now they go into these flex events and they say, when you come home at night at 5 o'clock tonight, in your electric car, don't plug it in. Wait till 10 o'clock tonight. when you come home tonight, don't turn on the electric stove we persuaded you to buy. No, because you can't do that either. And by the way, don't turn your air conditioner so that it's comfortable in your house. We're encouraging you not to use power. Even though we're at the very beginning of a summer, the temperatures are not nearly what they might be come August, but we're now telling you, if you don't voluntarily avoid using the power that PSE sells, we might just run out. We might have to have some areas that get blacked out. I think this is absolutely colossally criminal, because when you hook up to those utility companies, they have agreements with the state, and there are state laws that say that if you offer power for sale to your customers and you agree to hook them up, it is your obligation, Mr. Utility, to actually supply the power you promised to supply. So should Northwest Utilities be asking their customers to voluntarily not use power to avoid blackouts? And where does that tell you we are headed? I've told you before, the Northwest Power Planning Authorities, government authorities, have already said within about 4 years, we're going to be in a spot where we have a 1 in 3 chance of either rolling blackouts or brownouts throughout the region, because the folks who want us to switch to solar and wind have not provided enough electricity to meet demand. And therefore, they're going to start asking you to conserve. It's going to be like living in Iraq during Saddam Hussein, where only some towns got power turned on at some times. Now, maybe that's a bit of hyperbole, but fact is, should we in the most modern country on the planet, the most affluent country on the planet, be telling people, don't turn on your stove to cook dinner till 10 o'clock tonight because we need the power, otherwise we might have blackouts everywhere? I would say no. The utility companies should not be asking their customers not to use. The utility companies should be saying, we are going to build enough power plants to make sure you are supplied with the, well, the essential needs of modern society. You can find the X-Pole at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, the headline story, a well-known farm labor organizer in Washington's Skagit Valley, Alfredo Juarez Zeferino, has decided to give up his deportation fight and return to Mexico. When did the police stop him? 10 years ago in Bellingham. And they pulled him over for driving the wrong way on a one-way street. Well, clearly that was racial profiling. I don't think so, but that's exactly what Juarez claimed, and he went to court. And he sued the city of Bellingham, and he got to pocket $100,000 because he claimed that arresting a guy for driving the wrong way on a one-way street and then notifying ICE that this illegal alien had committed a traffic infraction, that that was racial profiling. But now he's decided. He's been arrested most recently, March the 25th. He was on his way to work in the tulip fields. He is a labor organizer. What does that tell you about where the unions stand about giving your jobs away to illegal aliens? The unions are complicit in it. He is a longtime labor organizer, and now he's decided to actually go back home to Mexico. Well, I say good riddance to Mr. Juarez. Back in just a moment. It's Tuesday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Seattle and Portland both plead collective ignorance when it comes to how to deal with violent people doing violent things. Lately, reporters have been bemoaning the death of Damon Lamar Johnson. His neighbors called the police because of his crazy behavior and the knives he was displaying. Officers took him into custody, handcuffed him, put him on the floor, and he died. We haven't seen the medical examiner's report yet, so what he died of is still a question. Journalist Richard Cheverton wrote about Johnson's plight. He lived in one of those so-called transition places provided for the otherwise homeless. You know, the ones that taxpayers have been funding with part of the $700 million the Portland area spent just last year, and the Puget Sound area about $1 billion a year on the so-called homeless problem that don't actually solve the problem. They just put these people in little boxes of about 106 square feet. The liberals who make decisions in this region don't want those violent people locked up, and they don't want the police to handle it. They're now demanding alternatives. Well, one of those alternatives, in this case, Portland Street Response, is supposed to be the multi-million-dollar alternative. But they go off duty at 10 o'clock at night. Apparently, nothing crazy happens after 10 o'clock at night. Actually, my personal experience is lots of crazy happens after 10 o'clock at night, so they're not available. Plus, Portland Street Response does not respond if the troubled person has weapons, like Damon Johnson's knives. To bottom line this, we have drug-addicted or mentally ill folks roaming the landscape, and when they turn dangerous, the folks who run the government have absolutely no solution. By the way, voters keep on electing these decision makers, so my advice is carry a gun and good luck. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS, and I'll get to those in just a moment. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Should electric customers cater to utilities that demand flex like PSE? Yeah. Doesn't make any sense to me. And the second question I've got, should California take the land of the people in Pacific Palisades whose houses burned down? And I kid you not, the state of California is allocating $100 million. If you thought that all those people with all those nice houses that burned to the ground in the Palisades fire because of the malfeasance of their local government, that they were going to rebuild quickly, did you believe all the promises made by the politicians saying, we're going to clear the decks, we're going to cut all the red tape, those people will be rebuilding very soon? No, their state lawmakers had different ideas. Do you know what they said? We're going to spend $100 million to build low-income housing on the land we take away from those folks who would like to get their nice houses back but will not be allowed to rebuild. And if that gives you an idea of where we're headed in the future, well, it gives me an idea, certainly. My favorite post on X today by the great investigative reporter Glenn Greenwald, the biggest scandal of the last 5 years is not that corporate media united to lie to the public about Joe Biden's cognitive decline, although that is a gigantic scandal. He writes, it is that unelected people exploited Joe Biden's cognitive decline to run the country in secret in Joe Biden's name. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, in this case not the Seattle Times, but OregonLive.com. On their editorial page, they're literally suggesting, now that the Portland Trailblazers may actually leave when they're sold, who knows where they're going to end up. But if they stay, they're going to stay at the Moda Center. And if you say, but didn't Paul Allen build the Moda Center with his own money? Yeah, more than 30 years ago. So it seriously is in need of a renovation. But guess who owns the Moda now? That would be the city of Portland. They took the sucker bet of buying it for a dollar. I told you it was a dumb idea at the time. It means the city and the county and the state gave up all the property taxes they used to get paid. When it was a private enterprise, it had to pay property taxes. As a publicly owned facility, it doesn't have to pay property taxes. And now the city is on the hook for any kind of renovation. So what do the rocket scientists down at Helen Jung's editorial page say? They say, hey, that jock tax that they're going to use to pay for the proposed Major League Baseball team stadium, the one that the city is also perhaps going to own and be responsible for. Here's the quote from the editorial. They might need to repurpose that jock tax for the Trailblazers, as controversial as it may be, considering these players' taxes already feed the state's general fund. There may be other revenue streams necessary for construction. So imagine this. The editorial page is suggesting that taxpayers now renovate the stadium so you can persuade the Trailblazers to stay in Portland. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I did it myself, and they did it for me. It's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Andrew writes, Lars, liberals love labels, and they're good at it. I'm pleased to announce the Fair Burg of Bellingham is no longer a sanctuary city. We are now a welcoming city. I wonder how welcoming the city will be to a mosque downtown with loudspeakers calling the faithful to prayer. Given that it's now been over 2 years to get a permit for a Chick-fil-A restaurant, or the grief given to the religious-affiliated Lighthouse Mission, whose mission is to help the poor, it would seem the new moniker is only a name and an ironic and meaningless one at that. The attempt to encapsulate a fake narrative requires a healthy dose of hypocrisy, which liberals excel at, signed Andrew. To your calls now. Let me start with John, who's a naysayer. Hey, John, welcome to the program. We love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about?
Well, as far as the utility companies, I don't think they should be asking. To make it fair and equitable, I just need to pull the plug on all those smart meters and let everyone pull
the plug. Hold on. They should be asking what? I've asked people, should the utility companies ask people, don't use your electric appliances or we're going to end up in a blackout? Should the utilities be doing that?
They shouldn't ask. They should just do it.
Pull it. They should just unplug meters, right? People? Why would they unplug people?
Well, for the... That way they're not asking to have people limit their power. They can do it through the smart meters, right?
Yeah, but what? But hold on. When a utility company gets the permission to operate as a utility in a state, Oregon or Washington, they are a regulated monopoly. It's one of the only monopolies allowed under the law in America, where they are a monopoly. They're guaranteed a return on their investment, but they, because they're a monopoly, they can't use that the way most monopolies would operate. But they're also obligated to provide the power that they've promised to provide. When the utility company says, we've decided to unplug all the coal plants, we've decided to go wind and solar, and we don't have enough juice, are they meeting their legal responsibility?
Do you believe every political promise to make it fair enough?
If it's in writing, it's a contract, John. And yes, I do believe that when you tell a utility company, you get to operate as a monopoly, you get a guaranteed return, which nobody else gets guaranteed return. But in exchange, when the people need the electricity, you will supply it. And now the utility companies are saying, we don't have enough power to supply that need, even on a day like today in the Northwest. John, thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. On Blue Sky at Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. I want to talk to our friend, the state representative, John Lee, retired airline pilot, reporter for Clark County Today. John, I want to talk to you about some of the stuff you've dug out about the latest scandals within transit and light rail. But I've got a piece of good news to share with you that I just learned myself moments ago. Glad to have you back on the show, by the way.
Hey, thanks for being here, and I love good news, so go for it, pal.
Well, here's the good news, that while the city of Portland is still pretending that they're anguishing and rubbing their hand, you know, wringing their hands and saying, oh, I don't know if we're going to hang on to our DEI stuff, or, but if we do, we'll lose $387 million, more than a third of $1 billion in government grants. But we really like that DEI stuff. We like it a lot. You know what they did? That's, I think, the signal of where it's going. There is a diversity, equity, and inclusion officer who is specified in the city budget at almost $250,000. By the time you put in benefits and vacation and all that, it's over $250,000 a year. I might have said billion, but it meant $250,000. So imagine this, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and you need somebody paid $229,000 in salary to run that operation. They have put that position on pause for right now. So I think they're going to make a lot of noise, and then eventually they'll say, oh, you know, it pains us to do this. But yeah, $387 million cash in hand, or hang on to our DEI nonsense. I think we'll take the cash. I think that's where they're going.
I love it. And now if we could get ODOT and WSDOT and the IBR to hit similar pause buttons, we'd be off to saving some people money.
Well, and you know who made that pause happen is President Trump said, this DEI stuff, we're done with it. We're not spending a bunch of federal money on diversity, equity, inclusion that is just institutionalized racism, saying, oh, you're getting hired not because of your skills and abilities, but because of what color you are, what pronoun you use, what nation you originated from, what gender you are, what gender you pretend to be. We're not doing that stuff anymore, and the money is gone. And the cities are going to have to make a tough choice. And, you know, John, I got to tell you something. I know that politicians are frequently compared to prostitutes. I think this is where they actually show what they are. When you say to them, do you want the money or do you want your closely held political beliefs? Guess which one they always choose.
No surprise there. Secret ballot, my friend.
No, and this is, I think, why Keith Wilson, the mayor of Portland, has come on the show once. The mayor of Seattle, Bruce Harreld, has never come on because we'd ask him questions like that. You're going to stick to your closely held liberal values of DEI, or do you want the cash instead? And they don't want to be asked that because it's kind of inconvenient. Let's talk about the red line. What is the red line in TriMet, and why is this so significant when it comes to buying new light rail trains?
Well, so almost a year ago, TriMet had a ribbon cutting on what they called the Better Red. And it was an extension of their Max Red Line for 10 miles from Beaverton to Hillsboro that they had projected they were going to spend $215 million on to improve service, quote unquote. There were three components of that. One was the extension of the line 10 miles to Hillsboro. The second was a significant upgrade to their Gateway Transit Center in East Portland. And then the third component was the addition of a second set of tracks from the Portland Airport in the direction of the Gateway Transit Center, but all of which for $215 million. Well, TriMet doesn't like to provide answers to very simple questions. How much does a mile of light rail track cost? How much does a new light rail station cost? They weren't providing that, so I did a public records request. In the end, they had spent $204 million on their project, and what we found was that in the end, they did not increase ridership. The red line runs about three quarters of the way in conjunction with the blue line. So the red line increased service by about 4,100 daily riders, but the blue line lost just over 5,000 riders. So after the expenditure of $204 million, oh my gosh, no new net increase in ridership along that line.
Actually, a net decrease of almost 1,000, right?
Yep, exactly right.
Wow, exactly you spend right. More money and you get worse results. That doesn't exactly sound like the hallmark. And by the way, you dug even deeper and you found out they were spending a lot of money on three things that you detail, and I want to know what they are. Systems, professional services, and civil. What is that? It costs a lot of money.
They didn't say, but they spent $96 million on those three categories, and you certainly could assume, maybe incorrectly, that professional services are things like engineers and architects that are potentially relevant to the construction of these things. But civil, oh my gosh, systems, my gut instinct is that especially systems and civil are pork barrel places where they can hide a lot of their day-to-day costs in and wrap it underneath the guise of this Better Red. But essentially, they spent $69 million on tracks and stations and rail cars. Well, that's what allegedly the taxpayers are buying. But yet they spend over 50% more for these civil and systems things. It's really ridiculous. Finally, before we run out of time, the other revelation was that they said they absolutely had to have four brand new light rail cars for right. this 10-mile extension. In the end, they only spent 62.5% of the $18 million allocated. They aren't saying how many vehicles they bought, whether it was two new vehicles or three, but bottom line is the Better Red has been operating now for almost a year without all of those vehicles, so they clearly didn't need four new vehicles for this 10-mile extension. And, of course, that ties into our favorite subject, the I-5 Interstate Bridge replacement, where TriMet's demanding 19 brand-new vehicles for a 1.8-mile light rail extension. What a huge ripoff of the taxpayers.
Well, and not only that, but the number I first got from John Lee, that extension, if they build the interstate bridge, I've said all along that I think it's a dead bridge walking because the bridge has lack of money, lack of funding, lack of approval from the Coast Guard, lack. And I don't think they're going to get the time of day from the Trump administration. And yet it's 1.83 miles at a total cost of $2 billion. And that's over $1 billion per mile, which makes it the most expensive light rail train in the world. Probably the most expensive of any kind of train, although maybe some of the Japanese bullet trains cost more. I know the one in Northern California costs more because it goes from nowhere to nowhere. And, but any train, that actually will have, tracks that have trains running on it. But the idea that they need 19 new vehicles to service a less than 2 mile stretch of rail. And we've invited Greg Johnson on. He's the guy who's pulling down six figures, a good, healthy six figure salary, kind of like the diversity, equity and inclusion officer and about as useful. He won't come on. He will only answer questions in writing. And even that is limited. I don't think he wants to be asked, why are you spending $1 billion a mile to build a light rail line? Why do you need 19 vehicles to service 2 miles of track when the city of the TriMet has 100 miles of track right now and they don't need that many vehicles? And how much of this are you dumping on taxpayers in another state? That is John Lee, state representative, retired airline pilot and a reporter for Clark County Today. When we get back, I'll get you your phone calls and your emails. And it is great news. Donald Trump makes some actions in D.C., and the city of Portland appears to be giving up its diversity, equity, and inclusion, institutionalized racism, sexism, and pronounism. Coming back in just a moment, you've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. Our X poll today, should Northwest utility companies ask customers to voluntarily not use electric power to avoid blackouts? My answer to that is no. They should do the job that they were contracted to do. They get a regulated monopoly situation. In exchange, they provide service. And for them to say, we don't have enough power to provide service, then for goodness sake, get out there and get some new power plants established and stop turning off the existing reliable plants that you have. So my answer to that is no, they should not do that. I'd love to hear the naysayer on that. Today's X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Bonnie. Hey, Bonnie, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to back up some stuff stuff that you talked about earlier, about the diversity, inclusion thing. Do you know about Bill 97?
No. What is
it? So Bill 97 was something signed for Oregon legislature that created.
Well, wouldn't
that
be just was it House Bill? Was it House Bill 97?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So they made it. I am a medical professional. I went to renew my licensure this year. And I, not only is my licensure gone up, I have to take this class now through Portland State because they don't honor what the hospitals in Portland and stuff are teaching us. They're causing, so my licensure is over $300 now because
yep.
OHA, or Health Authority, has the big monitor of all this. It's
yeah.
not your little branch. It's the big one.
Okay, I
and
get
now,
that, Bonnie, but I've got to get you to get to a point. What was the point you hoped to make? Every tax in Oregon that the Democrats can have the guts to raise is being raised right now.
It.
So what's the bottom line?
Yeah. The bottom line is they said there was going to be no financial impact, but there was. It's out of our pockets, and that's a Democratic state, you know? I guess that's my bottom line.
Is
I don't
that
like
right? Yeah, and here's the thing, Bonnie. If they say we're short of medical personnel, of doctors, nurses, and everybody else,
right.
And then they raise the cost of staying in that profession, do you think you're going to get more of something or less of something? They clearly don't understand the relationship that anytime you want less of something, tax the daylights out of it. Anytime you want more of something, take the taxes off. And you will get more
right.
of whatever it is you want, housing, food, or whatever. And but I'm not sure how that has anything to do with DEI. Are you forced to go ahead?
Well, I'm forced to take the extra DEI class that I've already had for the last 5 years at one of the bigger hospitals in Portland. And I find it that they think we are all stupid. I don't need to know how to be nice to humans. I don't have to agree with diversity or inclusion or all that. I just need to be nice to my
In other words, if somebody's a patient of yours, it really doesn't matter if they're male or female, black or white,
right.
Gay or straight.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You're going to offer them the same care, right?
Right. Correct.
So
I'm not
curious.
Biases. I'm not going to have improper speech. I've learned all this in the last 5 years. I don't
what would be, Bonnie, can you tell me this from those classes, what would be an example of improper speech?
Like, I would not call a Brazilian nut what my dad used to call it.
Okay.
A toe. Yeah.
Yep.
I don't want to say that word on
But, I mean, do you really have to, do professionals who are trained as nurses really have to be told, don't use racial epithets?
Yeah. I guess. I mean, I'm from a generation that, my parents were highly racist. But I had to learn through time that I had to be nice to humans, all humans. I don't
yep.
have to agree with them, but I have to be nice to them. And I think that's the bottom line.
I guess what I worry about, Bonnie, is the DEI ends up being an inbuilt bias. So in other words, they're saying, Bonnie, we have to teach you this because you're a white lady, and so therefore you are automatically racist. And you say, but I don't say or do things that would indicate that I'm racist. And they say, it doesn't matter. It's like magic beans. You are racist whether you know it or not. And you say, well, what did I do or say? They said, you see? The very fact that you don't recognize that you're it's like a psychological disorder, where somebody says, if I told you, Bonnie, if I was one of your patients and I said, well, before you do the exam, I need you to get all these other people out of the room. And you told me, Lars, there's nobody in the room. And I say, you don't see all the other people that are standing in the room with us? You would say, Mr. Larson has a psychological problem that we need to get the hospital shrink in here because he thinks there are people in the room. These are the DEI folks who say, oh, you claim you're not racist. Well, that proves that you are, because you don't even recognize your inbuilt systemic bias that's inside of you. And even though you don't do or say racist things, you are still a racist. This is a psychological disorder. And Bonnie, I appreciate the call. It's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And no, there are not other people standing in the room. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
Right.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the most frequent recommendations I make to people is if you want to get some permanent change made, you've got to get laws passed by Congress and laws passed by your state legislature. And failing that, at least you can go county by county and see if you can bring about change. And to do that, you have to put some conservative folks into those positions on, say, the county council, the city council, and the state legislature. Well, one of those, who I'm glad to see is running for office in Lane County, is Dr. Bob Zybeck. But this could be modeled anywhere in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, Seattle and Portland may be lost causes. Portland appears to be digging itself into a giant financial ditch right now that they may never escape from because they don't seem interested in making the changes they need to do. But other communities in the Northwest could actually rescue themselves by putting some conservatives in office. Dr. Zybeck, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. Good to be back.
Now, you're running for Lane County Commission, and tell people where to find your website and where to find out more about your stance on the various issues.
Okay, it's zybackforlane.com, Z-Y-B-A-C-H, not K, forlane.com, and I've got a Facebook page with the same name, Zybeck for Lane.
Okay, and Lane County in particular is a county, unlike Multnomah County, has not very many trees in it, but Lane County is covered with trees, with both trees owned by the county, may even be some owned by the city, but certainly owned by the state and by the federal government. So there's a lot of opportunity out there to create jobs in that county if the right decisions are made. Am I right?
Yes, we've got 1.5 million acres of Willamette National Forest and ONC lands just in my district, and Siusla National Forest has hundreds of thousands of acres in the western Lane district.
And by the way, I sent you an interview we did last week with the district manager for the BLM, in which even he admitted, he said, first of all, he didn't know whether Donald Trump was going to push for more logging in the forest, even though it's been in the news for about the last 4 months. And he also admitted, he said, we only cut what we're allowed to cut. Well, they're allowed to cut 350 million board feet, and they're only cutting 250. It sounds like a lot of opportunities are being bypassed.
Yeah, that's hundreds and hundreds of jobs. And as you pointed out, ONC lands grow 1 billion feet a year. And according to the 1937 ONC Act, that money is supposed to be going into counties. It was, I think, 75% back then. It's 50% now, but we're just getting a fraction of that, and they're not even meeting their minimum sales quota. It's a little bit odd.
So 1 billion board feet of trees, just to translate that for folks, you and I have been going back and forth on this one, not disagreeing, but if you cut 1 million board feet of lumber, you know, you cut down the trees that equal 1 million board feet. We could explain what a board foot is. It's a way of measuring lumber in a big round tree that's still standing up. That creates somewhere between 8 and 11 new jobs. It may be more to one end or the other. But if it's 1 billion board feet, that's 8,000 to 11,000 new jobs. That's a complete game changer for the Pacific Northwest, isn't it?
Yes, and that's the way we operated for several decades before the spotted owl and environmental litigation and government regulations created the current situation of unemployment and massive wildfires and a lot of dead wildlife.
K, Can we agree that the spotted owl and all those similar situations turned out to be a big scam by the scientists or by some scientists to shut down logging, but not for real reasons?
I think it's more than the scientists. The taxpayers are footing the bill, but it's the environmental law industry that has just exploded with the Equal Access to Justice Act and spotted owls as their weapon of choice.
You know, it's funny, I got an email from a gentleman this morning who takes the opposite point of view that I do, and he said, Lars, there's plenty of forest on private lands, leave the public lands alone. And I wrote back to him and I said, have you checked the numbers? A third of the region, of the Pacific Northwest region, is private forest. Two-thirds of it is government-owned forest. So if you limit it to just the private lands, limiting supply of anything drives the price up and means you're not going to get as much of it. If you open up the public lands for sensible, sustained-yield logging, you'd get fewer fires, more jobs, lots of tax revenue, and maybe America wouldn't have to import 28% of its dimensional lumber for building houses.
That's exactly right. Another factor is, when you have all those people that should be working in the woods, according to the laws, Organic Act, the ONC Act, then the private companies pay lesser wages because they've got kind of the pick of the litter. There's more people looking for fewer jobs, and so the situation becomes economically disadvantaged for the people looking for work. And so that's been a real problem.
The ones who have the skills. You liked one of my ideas, and Dr. Zybeck, I've been pitching for close to 30 years the idea of a forest dividend, much like the Alaska dividend that comes from oil, that instead of giving the money that the federal government gets for cut on federal lands to the states and the counties, set up a dividend so that everybody in the state gets a check. Now, I'm not just aiming at putting checks in people's pockets, but if you live in a city, and your only experience with the woods is occasionally taking a hike or driving a highway that goes through the forest, they don't mean much to you. But if logging meant that every year your family got a dividend from that activity, all of a sudden, whether or not a politician either favors logging or opposes it, it becomes a big deal to even the person who never goes out in the woods. And you like that idea. You think it's doable?
I don't know if it's doable, but it certainly should be considered. I think it's a great idea. If people have a vested interest in the forest, then they will learn about it. The problem with people in cities is not only are they ignorant for several generations, not only have most of our people moved to cities in the last 50 years or so, but they're getting inundated by smoke from these fires, and that's killing 10,000 to 15,000 people a year, according to recent studies. So these wildfires are not only devastating for the rural communities, they're also deadly for people that live in cities and don't understand the results of their political actions.
Well, and if we did regular and routine, if we increased logging substantially and did it on a sustained yield basis, could we cut dramatically the number of fires?
Yes, and we've proven that before. These fires are fueled by trees, dead trees, snags, logs on the ground, brush. We saw it in L.A. in January of this year. So you remove the fuels or cut them way back. The Indians did it with prescribed fire. The loggers used to do it with clear cuts and other methods, thinning. And we know that the fires would be less severe and probably smaller, and the air would be a lot cleaner and there'd be a lot more wildlife.
Yeah, and maybe we could create a forest dividend and make people care about logging. Right now, most people could not name a single person that they know who is a logger or was a logger. I know plenty of them. That's Dr. Bob Zybeck, including Mike Peel, who's a very good logger. Dr. Zybeck, thanks very much. He's running for Lane County Commissioner. Coming up in a moment, how many of you have time to play video games 4 hours a day and watch TV for six? I'll tell you about one group of Americans doing exactly that.
Are you experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. How many of you have time to play video games 4 hours a day, every day of the week, and watch TV for 6 hours a day? Now, that's 10 hours in total. And if you say, well, who's doing that? There is one particular large group of Americans in numbers in the millions, and they are in that group. That's what they do. And let me give back that up. And let me tell you, here's what how they're doing it. They're not working at a job. You say, oh, they must be independently wealthy. No, they're not independently wealthy. They are on Medicaid. Now, that doesn't pay all their bills, but if they're signed up for Medicaid, then they're going to be getting other things as well. TANF, SNAP, Section 8, Medicaid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And let me tell you why this is important right now. An awful lot of your friends, and I want to encourage you to push back on them when they say, why, Donald Trump, he's cutting millions of people from Medicaid. Here's what I'd encourage you to tell them. Absolutely damn right he's cutting millions of people off Medicaid. And when your friend gets that shocked look on his or her face, you say, you're right. He's cutting three big groups of people that number in the millions, and they should be cut off. And again, your friends, if they're liberal, woke types, they're going to get that shocked look on their face. I can't believe you're saying that. How can you be saying that? Well, I'll tell you how. And you have a good answer for them. You say, would you like me to tell you the three big groups of people that are being cut off Medicaid? And it's going to cut millions of people out of the program and save tens of billions of dollars. The program is still getting bigger, by the way. Medicaid is scheduled to grow by about $1 trillion in the coming 10 years. So it's still getting bigger, but it's not going to get bigger as fast because they're going to cut three groups of people who deserve to be cut. And then it becomes important to take a look at, well, what are those people doing and why can't they go out and work a part-time job? Now, that's the requirement because that's all Trump is doing. He's not actually cutting people. He's just saying, if you're on Medicaid right now, and because of the largesse of previous Democrat administrations, both in Washington, D.C. and at the local level, these people have been allowed to stay on Medicaid, even though in federal law it says there is a work requirement. Now, who signed that evil work requirement for Medicaid? Well, that would be the horny hick from Arkansas, Bill Clinton, signed that back in 1996. And if you say, well, if there are requirements in federal law, why isn't federal law being followed? And the quick answer is that blue states have decided they don't want to follow that requirement. They don't want to tell people, in order to get this freebie, free health insurance paid for by the taxpayers, for which the Medicaid recipient pays nothing, you have to work a part-time job, at least 20 hours every week. Well, then it becomes important to ask yourself, well, what are these people doing with their time during the day that keeps them from working? Let me go through all of that. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's easy. Just call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, you can go right to the head of the line. Be glad to put you first in line. Just come prepared with your best argument, maybe some facts and a little bit of logic. And if you want to send an email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. You can also vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day at Lars Larson Show on X and at LarsLarson.com on our website. So, what have they proposed to do? Well, the three groups that are going to get cut. Number one, ask your liberal friends. They want to cut all illegal aliens off the rolls of Medicaid. You say, hold on, illegal aliens, are they allowed to get Medicaid? No, they're not under federal law. But the states, the 22 blue states in America, have all decided we ought to give this benefit to people who don't even have the legal right to be here and don't have any right to work a job here. Now, if you agree with that, I'd love to hear the naysayer call. Tell me why you would tell your fellow taxpaying citizens you need to pay for health insurance for people who don't have any right to be here. The second group that gets cut off is all of the doctors and the medical institutions, clinics, hospitals, things like that, that are engaged in mutilation of children, surgical, genital mutilation, and sometimes chemical mutilation of children in the name of transgender care. They get cut off Medicaid under Trump's plan. And then the third group, this is my favorite group, what I call the deadbeat group. And why do I call them deadbeats? Here's why. Because under the plan, The Obamacare Medicaid was expanded dramatically, but under Trump, it is going to be cut back by cutting out the illegal aliens, the mutilating Mengele doctors who are doing all that evil stuff with children, transgender surgery, transgender hormones, and all that. But the third group, the deadbeat group, what they are told under federal law is if you want to have Medicaid, you've got to at least work a part-time job, minimum of 20 hours a week. Now, that's not asking a lot. You could work a part-time job, knock off 20 hours a week, but it might cut into your free time. So guess what happened? Well, they went out and they did a study, and they tried to figure out, what are these people on Medicaid who are childless? That's one criteria. Not pregnant, and men can't get pregnant. By the way, for all you woke folks out there, men can't get pregnant. So childless, not pregnant, working age, not a child, not an elderly person, and physically able, physically fit. If you are all of those, you know, you're a childless individual or couple who is not physically or mentally disabled, you have to work a job 20 hours a week to be able to do that. So what'd they do? They took a look at that group and said, what are these people doing with their free time? For Medicaid recipients who do not report that they have a job, this is from the Federalist, the most common activity after sleeping is watching television and playing video games. They spend an average of 4.2 hours per day watching TV and playing video games, or about 125 hours during a 30-day month. That's almost as many hours as there are in a work month. There are about 160 hours in a work month, 40 times 4. They spend about 6.1 hours per day, or 184 hours per month, socializing, relaxing, and leisure activities, including television and video games. So they're spending most of their time doing nothing. Given that non-workers, this is what the Federalist says, on the Medicaid rolls spend more than 180 hours per month watching TV, playing video games, relaxing, conversing, goofing off, he says it seems entirely reasonable for the government to require such individuals to devote less than half that time, 80 hours a month, 20 hours a week, working, volunteering, or engaging otherwise in productive activities as a condition of receiving taxpayer-funded health coverage. Seems reasonable to me as well. Let me go to Frank. Hey, Frank, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
How you doing, Lars? Hey, earlier today you were talking with a retired pilot about Link Light Rail.
Yep.
And you had said that the most expensive one you've seen was $1 billion per mile.
Yes, sir.
Well, here you go. This will beat that. There's a 7-mile line going from West Seattle to Ballard that right now is coming in at between $1.5 to $2 billion per mile.
Oh, my God. I mean, that is outrageous. And this one hasn't, yes, they haven't even started construction on it yet, have they?
No. No, they have. In fact, they're still fighting over the pathway of it. They haven't bought the property for it because they don't know exactly where it's going.
$1.5 to $2 billion a mile. Absolutely outrageous. And since they haven't even started it like the IBR, there's still time to dodge that bullet.
The Lars Larson Show. Everyone's favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. By the end of this week, the Congress is likely to pass what's called the Genius Act, which promotes something called stablecoin. We got to talk about what this is and whether or not it pushes America toward a cashless system, which, by the way, I'm not in favor of. Maybe Christian Briggs can persuade me otherwise, although I'm not necessarily looking for Christian to do that. Christian, welcome back.
First of all, it's an honor to be on your show, and the Genius Act is quite a topic, isn't it, today?
It is, and I'm just curious. Let's start out with, what does the Genius Act cover, and where's the intersection between that and stablecoin? And what is stablecoin?
Well, Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Yeah, no, you said it right. You've got three acts here that are trying to get passed in the House today, which were all three were defeated. The first was Genius Act, which was obviously passed in the Senate. Senator Tim Scott and Senator William Hagerty, obviously of Tennessee, and respect Tim Scott of South Carolina, those were passed. Okay. That Genius Act passed. It goes to the House under the Clarity Act. French Hill is obviously the lead sponsor of the bill in the House. And then you have what they call the Anti-CBDC Act, and then the Genius Act itself, which kind of merged with the Clarity. So all three of those acts were defeated today, because what's happening is inside the Genius Act, if you want to kind of understand a little bit here, in Section 3 of the Genius Act, it makes it unlawful for any person or company to issue a payment stablecoin in the United States without being a permitted payment stablecoin issuer. Now, in plain language, no government license, no stablecoin. Very simple. It's like having a bank license to be able to take deposits and do that. But here's where it gets interesting. The law defines permitted issuers to include, one, insured depository institutions, banks, obviously, that's where you want to keep it, or their subsidiaries that have regular approval. The problem is, though, is that because the stablecoin is tracked so heavily under a surveillance provision, it's not called surveillance, but it is in the Genius Act, it's very clearly to where the government has the right, and believe me, they'll take full ability to do anything they can in order to be able to surveil any movement. It's almost like in real time the movement of money, which it really is, because there are different provisions in the Genius Act that can work in favor of monitoring nefarious things, which I mean I'm all for. The problem is they can also flip a switch, and then you can now turn that money off even without predisposed or with a very minimal presumptuous of guilt, kind of like, you know, the asset forfeiture laws, which take about $8 billion, which is horrible,
And by the way, Christian, I don't want to sound like a Neanderthal, but those are my two objections to a CBDC, which, by the way, for people listening, is a central bank digital currency. I'm not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of money that can be turned off, on and off, at the whim of the government. And I'm not in favor of money in a form in which every single purchase or transaction I make can and I think will be tracked by the government.
Well, and I'm all for what you just said. I mean, I'm on the same page, my brother. But you got to remember one thing. Under the Genius Act, the bill was written by two very, very good people, highest level of integrity, highest level of character. You can't beat Tim Scott or Bill Hagerty. That's a fact.
I agree.
But remember, it's kind of like the Federal Reserve. When Woodrow Wilson did two horrible things, now we realize this. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department for the Internal Revenue Service, both in 1913, both were novel ideas that were supposed to offer value to the American citizens and the sovereignty of the dollar, or at least the currency. Because once you lose your currency, you lose your sovereignty, you lose your nation when it goes, ask Venezuela how that worked out.
Yeah, no
kidding. And any other countries, okay? But the Genius Act had mechanisms in there that under a good conservative, morally correct administration, it's administered perfect, no problem. However, we've seen what the Biden administration did with the dementia patient and how bad and corrupt they were with all the handlers. So you get the wrong person in there with the wrong levers to pull. The Genius Act pushed over to the House under the Clarity Act could be nefarious from a government surveillance and control mechanism. That's the problem. The language is good. It wasn't great. The language needs to be perfect in order to be able to maintain the consistency of the privacy of individuals, two, the compliance of individuals, but due process must be given first. Under the Genius Act, if the wrong person is in control of those levers, they can be very subject to very little oversight, that they could just punish somebody by turning off their money. And if they turn off their money, what are you going to do? How are you going to pay your bills? How are you going to pay lawyers to be able to prove you're innocent because you're guilty?
And that's, I'm talking to Christian Briggs, who's an economist by training and a CEO at Hard Asset Management, HAM. Christian, that's the concern I've got, because right now, I mean, don't worry, I don't have enough money to wander around with $10,000 or $20,000 in my pocket. But there are people who have a legitimate business, or they don't trust the government, and they have some money in their pocket. And then they get stopped. And they're told by the government, the police officer, why are you carrying this much in cash? And it's one thing, I guess, if you're going across the border and you're taking that much money out of the country or in the country, the general limit is $10,000. If you're carrying $100,000 in cash in a suitcase, and they say, what are you doing with this money? The government has said, it's our business what you're doing with the money. And as you point out, in many cases, even inside the United States, I remember they stopped a guy years ago who was going, he was in Chicago, he ran a landscaping business. He'd go to, he'd fly down to Texas, you know, buy a bunch of landscaping materials for thousands and thousands of dollars, load them up on a trailer and drive them back to Chicago. It was cheaper than using other suppliers, and it helped his business. He had a legitimate reason. He was carrying, I don't know, $15,000-$20,000 in cash, and all of a sudden his money is seized. He's out of business, he's in custody, and he hadn't done anything wrong. Now, he eventually got it back, but imagine if the government could look online and say, hey, that Christian Briggs, he's doing something funny, he's doing a lot of these transactions, and they look weird. Let's turn his money off for a while and see what happens. I don't think that's legit, unless, of course, they go into court and say, Your Honor, here's probable cause that Christian Briggs is, I don't know, trafficking in jujubes, or I won't make it fentanyl for today's example, and your money is turned off. And you say, hold on, do I have any rights here?
Under the law, under forfeit asset forfeiture, you have zero laws, zero rights, zero anything until you sue the government. And if you sue the government, and it happens many times, to where there is a presumption of guilt that is 99% of the equation with 1% opportunity to say, no, I'm innocent, and then, but you got to prove it. Costs very big money to hire lawyers these days. So if you look now, the House defeated. They voted no. All the Republicans said no. Marjorie Taylor Greene went on the record just in the last 35, maybe 45 minutes, that there was a back door inside the Genius Act, not nefariously put in there by any means by the Republicans. It wasn't. But it was there to where if you technically read the language, it could be used to open up or at least be a gateway for a central bank digital currency. Marjorie Taylor Greene said no to back doors on CBDC. So remember this, you know, you hate them, love them, not so sure, kind of on the fence. The Republicans may sometimes have a little differences of opinion here and there. They may sometimes offer a left or a right, a black or white. But here's what they are always united about. They will never allow, and Donald Trump is exactly the same way. He's a man of faith. He's a great businessman. He's just a great guy. They will never allow something to be put into position to where only because you have good integrity and character is it going to work. Because not every day that man in that chair in that Oval Office behind the resolute desk will be a man of God. And if once we don't have that, like Joe Biden's proved it, he's not a man of God.
No, and then what you've got is a bunch of staffers who have an auto pen, and they say we can sign off on anything we want. Christian, thanks very much. That is Christian Briggs, economist and CEO at Hard Asset Management. Christian, it's always a pleasure. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show on X.
Lars' daily question to all the Dems in our government.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Now, the one with the brain, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So I see this headline that says, the owners of Unger Century Berry Farms believe that Picker's ties to the community and previous experience of the farm helped convince them to take the risk of coming to America to pick berries. Now, this is all about agriculture, which I generally support, wanting to employ illegal aliens to actually do the hot and heavy work of going out and picking the berries. Now, I think that any business that has to sustain itself on a steady supply of what amounts to indentured servants, that is, illegal aliens who do that job, yes, it pays more than it would pay in their own home country. And coming to our country illegally, that is aiding and abetting people. And it seems the owners of these farms as much as admit that they know they're employing illegal aliens. And you say, well, Lars, what are you going to do instead? I've got a great idea. I mean, I picked strawberries and I picked beans when I was a kid. I did it for two summers, and I made decent money. In fact, I remember making about $10 or $12 a day. Some of my friends and some of their sisters, usually girls were a whole lot better at picking strawberries than guys. And that's not because we got into strawberry fights, because I didn't do that. I wanted to make money. I wasn't getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get on a bus at 4:30 to get to the Berry Fields by 6 a.m. and then pick till 2 and then get home around 4 in the afternoon. I mean, that's a long day. You say, well, you can't have kids do that kind of work. Can I ask you something? Have you heard about the fact that a disproportionate number of American kids are obese? A number of American kids who can't get off the couch and get away from the TV and the video games? Do you think that's a problem? Well, I've got a solution to both problems. Number one, let's get kids back picking berries. And the reason I mentioned the dollar amount, because it taught me about capitalism and incentives early on. I was, 12? I think I was 12 years old when I did my first year, 13 when I did my second year. By 14, I was working in a furniture store, another job that you probably can't have kids do, although it didn't hurt me at all. But when we were picking berries, they told you, here's the way it works. You get paid $1 for a flat of berries. If you're not familiar with a flat, it's about 3 feet long, about foot and a half wide, and it has those little cartons in it that you put strawberries in. So you fill one of those up. You don't put rocks in the bottom of the baskets or cheat or anything like that. And you only pick the good berries that every time you brought a flat up, you got $1 a flat. When you got to 5 flats, every flat after that paid $1.10. So you tried to get to 5 flats as fast as you possibly could. Now, what would I get in a day? Usually 10 to 12 flats, which means I made about, you know, $10 to $12, a little bit more for the flats that paid $1.10. Now, that means that at age 12, I could knock down about $60 a week and not work the weekends at all. So, $60 a week. Do you know of a single job in which a 12 or 13-year-old today can make, and I'm not talking about illicit jobs, things like drugs and things like that. I'm talking about legitimate jobs. Do you know of a single job in which you say, my kid wants to go out and actually earn the money? I don't want to just give him the money. I want him to have the experience, or her to have the experience, of actually earning the money. Now, do you know of a job where a kid can make $60 a week at age 12? And $60 a week these days is worth a whole lot less than $60 was worth back in the day. I mean, $60 back then would have bought, what'd that be? 55 cents a gallon? About 100, what was that? About 100 gallons of gas or 10 gallons of gas? In any case, no, it would buy a lot of gasoline. It put money in my pocket. And for the life of me, I can't understand why. You say, well, parents wouldn't trust their kids to be out in the berry fields. Let me tell you something. When you get on a bus at 4 o'clock in the morning with a bunch of other kids, you're driven to the berry fields, you're surrounded by other kids, so it's, you know, most of the kinds of things that you might worry about happening are not going to happen. You're stuck out in a berry field, which was, I think, today I know that it's about 15 miles away from a big city and probably 5 miles or a couple of miles away from a small city. You can't get into trouble in the middle of a berry field other than those berry fights. But wouldn't that make more sense to have kids do that kind of work? I figure that an awful lot of those jobs are going to end up being mechanized out of existence altogether. And that's not necessarily a bad thing either. The second thing I want to raise to your attention is about our X poll today. The question is, should Northwest Utilities ask their customers to voluntarily not use electric power to avoid blackouts? And if you say, well, Lars, it sounds reasonable, do them a favor. No. How about telling the utilities, you have an obligation of universal service. You've agreed to be a regulated monopoly. You get a regulated return on investment, so the companies make money no matter what. You have a locked-in crowd of people who buy your product. It is considered a necessity. And I get this note from Bruce in Kirkland. Lars, 9:57 this morning, my phone rings with an automated message from PSE, Puget Sound Energy, that we're going to have a flex event today from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. People like me who live in an old house with no AC and drive cars powered by gasoline are supposed to eschew using the oven or even the dryer, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Why? Because the idiots that run PSE don't realize that they have the bulge on the state of Washington. If all the utilities and all the natural gas providers and refiners of any form of energy told Olympia to go pound sand and stop buying their car credits, what would happen? Nothing, except we'd all have less expensive and more reliable energy. But what is PSE doing instead? They continue to subsidize conversion from gas appliances to electric, adding tons of demand to the grid, and then they turn around and ask their customers, please don't use our electricity. We aren't making enough of it to meet the demand. Well, Universal Service suggests to me they have a legal obligation to meet demand. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Glad to have you call at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Boy, you don't have any shortage of complaints about the big, beautiful bill from those on the left. The only problem is, while the mainstream cartel media is happy to amplify their complaints, when you actually look at what they're complaining about, in my view, they're actually complaining about things that make things better. So I thought we'd talk about it with Washington State Senator John Braun, who joins me now, head of Washington State's Senate GOP caucus. Senator Braun, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on, Lars.
So tell me about this. How is the big, beautiful bill going to help Washington State, despite what all your friends on the other side of the aisle say about it?
Yeah, we've heard a lot of fear-mongering from the other side, but when you actually look at what the bill does, and it is a big bill, it covers a lot of stuff. A lot of talk has been about Medicaid and the concerns about that. When you look at what it does, it brings in accountability and to make sure that the program survives long-term to serve the folks that it was intended to, the elderly, the folks in extreme poverty, disabled children, by doing things like creating a work requirement. Not a really high bar. It's 20 hours a week, either working or looking for work or volunteering or even school counts. But make sure folks are working to get themselves on a good track in the future. Not a bad thing. In fact, a very good thing. It does some other things like ensure you're eligible. You know, some of the waivers put in place by President Biden over his term. You know, we think we have millions of people across the country and lots of folks in Washington State who are using Medicaid and aren't really eligible, which means they're taking money away from the vulnerable folks it's supposed to serve. And then the other one I like to mention, because we talked a lot about it during this last session here in Washington, is there's a number of people in Washington and in other places across the country who are enrolled in multiple states, and it could be any number of reasons why they're enrolled in multiple states. But it's called, so we're basically paying double for no good end. They're not getting more health care as a result. In Washington State alone, we know if we remove the dual enrollees, we'd save $150 million a year. That's big money, and money that could go to other more useful purposes. So, you know, they're worried about the changes in Medicaid. In Washington, these will actually save money and allow us to redirect that money where it can be used more efficiently, more effectively for the folks who really need it.
Well, and in fact, is this just an objection because the three big groups being cut, the mutilating Mengele doctors who are doing genital surgery and chemicals on kids? I can't imagine even the most the most tried and true Democrat would say, oh, we got to make sure the doctors can still chop up your kids. I don't think that, you know, who's going to defend that? And then illegal aliens who shouldn't be on the program at all, but both Washington and Oregon see fit to work around the federal rules that bar illegals and say, we're going to give it to them anyway. That, again, cheats citizens. And then the deadbeats, like you said, I mean, I'm just calling them deadbeats out loud, Senator, because if you're and the requirements under the big, beautiful bill are they can demand that you work at least 20 hours a week, but only if you are childless, not pregnant, not a child, not the elderly, working age adult with no kids and not pregnant and mentally and physically capable. So you put all those criteria in, you say you're paying for health insurance with the taxpayers' money for people who won't go get a job at least 20 hours a week, who don't have any kids to take care of. They're not elderly. They're not children. They're just working age adults who don't want to work. Well, why would you want to pay for them?
That's a common sense reform, one that, if asked independently, is broadly supported by Republicans and Democrats, independents. It's just because it's a Republican idea that our Democratic friends are attacking it, because they're trying to Washington, they're genuinely trying to distract from the harm they did during this last session, where they put $13 billion in new taxes, mostly levied against working Washingtonians. They approve that, and they don't want folks to pay attention to that. So they're trying to distract with arguments that, you know, when you really dig in, just don't make sense. This is just good policy, good accountability, making sure that we're delivering services to the most vulnerable without just wasting money on folks who can and should be able to go out and work a minimum number of hours per week.
Well, and isn't Washington State doing a different form of what Oregon is doing, where they overtax the hospitals, tell the hospitals to submit a bigger bill to Medicaid, to the federal government, and then when the money comes back and the hospitals say, but you taxed us, the state of Washington under Ferguson just turns around and gives them the money back to care for the people on Medicaid, you know, to provide for the people on Medicaid who aren't qualified for it, meaning people in the country illegally. Washington is still doing that scam, are they not?
Yeah, Washington is doing this in a number of ways for a long time. It's been a risky proposition from the very beginning. It was never intended, even under the original Obamacare proposals. In fact, what the Republicans have proposed from the Congress is basically to take it, those types of funding mechanisms back to the original proposal in Obamacare. They're not getting rid of it. And just to be clear, it's terrible policy the way it's funded. But in healthcare, you do genuinely have to be careful as you shift that you don't leave something uncovered for a period of time. But they don't do that. They transition over 5 years, 0.5% a year, to a more logical standard program. Give states and healthcare organizations time to transition. It's thoughtfully done, and it's the right thing to do, because what we're doing right now is just bad policy that's been abused by Washington and other states around the country.
Are there other major changes that came in that big, beautiful bill that you've noticed that are of particular use to Washington residents?
Well, there's a couple I would highlight, at least in general. Well, three I'd highlight. One, nobody wants to talk about the tax reduction, and this is a big deal. I mean, right now, you know, under current law, he simplified the tax code a number of years ago. Most folks don't itemize, use a standard deduction. It's $30,000. Without this bill, it would have dropped down to $12,500. That means whatever your tax rate is, you're paying your taxes on $17,500 more. That's a big number for folks. And
yeah,
should
figure
not be
at least 20% of that number, so about $3,000. That's the least you're going to see. And you might see as much as a $6,000 tax jump without it.
That's right. So Democrats out there saying is we should increase your taxes so we can provide insurance, free insurance for able-bodied folks. It just doesn't make any sense. Beyond that, there's energy provisions in here that will help make energy less expensive in the future. Exactly the opposite of what the Democrats here in Washington have done over the last few years, is just drive up energy costs. I think that will help us long term. And then a lot of stuff in there, not getting a lot of talk, but essentially there's almost an entire ag bill in there to help the agricultural sector. And that's important in Washington, one of the biggest economic drivers, especially in eastern Washington. Really good stuff for ag long term.
Absolutely. That's John Braun, senator from Washington State. He's also the Senate's GOP caucus chair. Senator Braun, thanks very much. Back in a moment. We're going to talk about Anthony Fauci and the pardon he got from Joe Biden. But did Joe actually sign it? That's next.
Does Does Lars finally agree with Chuck Schumer?
Of course there's some wasteful spending, but you don't use a meat axe and cut everything.
Pass out the chainsaws and welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about the auto pen just one more time. I know the last couple of days we've talked about the auto pen. This is the mechanical device that can simulate anybody's signature, in this case, the signature of an American president. Is it legal for a president to use it to sign a bill or a memo or an executive order or even a pardon? It is legal to use it. But the intention is, in the same way that many of us, if you're doing a big transaction like buying a car, buying a house, you might be asked to make electronic signatures that you use to sign documents instead of having to get in your car and drive down to a title office or drive down to the car dealership to sign the sign some piece of paperwork that they forgot about on the day that you did the transaction. I understand that. And when presidents have used it, Obama, I believe, was the first to actually sign a bill into law. It was in use before that, but they had not used it to sign a bill into law. And Obama was apparently on one of his many vacations to Hawaii and said, I don't want to come all the way back to Washington, D.C. to sign that bill, so use the auto pen. Well, the Biden administration, the Biden White House, ended up using the auto pen for thousands of documents because of all the many pardons, commutations, and other things that got signed, allegedly by Joe Biden. One of those pardons went to a notorious, sketchy, nefarious person by the name of Dr. Anthony Fauci. And why would Joe Biden need to pardon Dr. Fauci? Was Dr. Fauci accused of a crime? Not yet. Was Dr. Fauci convicted of a crime? Not yet. But I think that a lot of us believe that Dr. Anthony Fauci did things that were criminal. Well, we're never going to find out because he's got a presidential pardon. The only question now is, was the pardon actually signed at Joe Biden's direction, or was it signed because somebody on Joe Biden's staff decided to give Dr. Anthony Fauci a pardon? It may be that we will never truly find out the answer to that question, but I want to give you some details about what has come out recently about Dr. Fauci, the pardon he got, and whether or not Joe Biden actually directed his staff to have the auto pen sign it, or whether his staff just decided to do it on their own, which they had absolutely no authority to do. And I think that is a significant question. If you decide to pardon a figure like Dr. Anthony Fauci, who played such a bizarre role during the pandemic when it hit America, and in all the different advice he gave and all the conflicting testimony that he gave before the U.S. Congress, I think Fauci ought to be prosecuted. Only now he's got a presidential pardon for any federal crimes. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day. But let me point out some of the reporting on this by the Federalist. Fauci is at the root of almost all the government-inflicted suffering that happened in the United States during the COVID pandemic. They make a great case that Fauci is the center of all this. Do you remember when a lot of us pointed out that a virus appeared to come from the Wuhan Institute of Virology? And why would Anthony Fauci lie to America about that? Well, because he was behind the decision making to send millions of dollars, it may have been hundreds of millions, to the lab in China. And you might ask, well, why are we sending American taxpayer money to a country that is less than friendly toward the United States? I would even call them an enemy of the United States. And China clearly intends to supplant the United States financially, diplomatically, militarily, and every other way that their Chinese communist heart desires. So, has Fauci been charged with a crime? No. He has not. And yet on Joe Biden's last day in office, he received or allegedly received a pardon that was designed to blunt the results of any COVID investigation done by either the U.S. Congress or Donald Trump's second term administration. But here's what we know now. Biden did not personally sign Fauci's pardon. Now, Biden did personally sign. It's worth noting. He did personally sign the pardon for his son, Hunter. And Biden is now giving the explanation that, well, you know, on those pardons, when he was talking about the criminals that were in jail who had been convicted of crimes. There were so many of them that we used the auto pen instead. The auto pen managed by his White House staff secretary, Stephanie Feldman, made that signature. And the New York Times this week, I talked about this report yesterday, the report by Charlie Savage and Tyler Page said there is no proof that Biden even knew about Fauci's pardon or about the specifics of his other pardon. So if he didn't know about them, even if you're allowed to use the auto pen, again, it's the same. I see a real parallel to what many of us have done. If you've bought a house recently, you may have signed a lot of the documents electronically. Is that actually your signature? The answer is no, but as long as everybody is satisfied that that electronic signature actually indicates that you wanted that document signed and you merely used an electronic means to sign it instead of signing it with a piece of paper, a real piece of paper, what they call a wet signature in the document business, you can sign it electronically. But you know what you're signing. You're aware of the documents and you take responsibility. They may be the, you know, your promise to repay hundreds of thousands of dollars if you're buying a house, tens of thousands of dollars if you're buying a car. But if Joe Biden didn't even know about the pardon, according to the New York Times, emails indicate that Feldman wanted written confirmation of Joe Biden's purported verbal approvals before producing an auto pen signed pardon document. So aides to Biden's senior advisors emailed her with so-called blurbs with instructions. The aides were told by senior advisors what to include in the blurb. A blurb is a short paragraph or a couple of sentences. The aides were not in the room when Biden made the alleged pardon decisions. The pardon decisions had a broken chain of custody. That means it left ample opportunity for the advisors or the aides to change or add to what Biden said if they bothered to meet with Joe Biden at all. Now, the pardon directions had a broken chain of custody. It is fascinating, they write, that Biden did not even put an internal signature on the list of pardons showing the executive actually approved of them. It was all done by his staff. Total deniability. Imagine that. The New York Times says it talked to Joe Biden for 10 minutes on the phone. He couldn't spare more time because 10 minutes is hardly enough time to learn everything there is about the more than 4,000 clemencies issued under Joe Biden's name. Let's go to Carolyn. Hey, Carolyn, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
To learn everything there is.
Hey, Carolyn, turn off your radio.
Clemencies.
No, she's not listening. So I'm going to move on to other things. Carolyn, better luck next time. But when the producers ask you, and they, Joel asks very politely, will you please turn your radio off? If you leave it on, then it's going to make it very difficult to talk to you on the radio. And in fact, you're not going to hear real time. So I'm sorry for that, but that's the way that goes. Now, our X poll today, should Northwest Utilities ask their customers to voluntarily not use electric power to avoid blackouts? Apparently, Puget Sound Energy, according to my emailer, who says he was asked today by PSE to voluntarily not use his electric oven or his electric air conditioner from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. That is what they call a flex, meaning the power company is running out of power and they're asking you, don't use the power. We aren't making enough to satisfy the need.
The Lars Larson Show. Sayers go to the head of the line at the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. They say that there are only two guarantees, and that is death and taxes. But I would add a third one. Anything involving the economy that was good during Joe Biden is guaranteed in the minds of the cartel media to be bad under Donald Trump. So let's talk about inflation. And Ryan Young joins me now, who's a senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Hey, Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So is inflation up or down? Because I hear month over month, it's up. But if you compare it year over year, it's actually relatively flat. And it's lower than it was expected to be by the economic experts out there. So the mainstream media will tell you it's Donald Trump's economy. Therefore, inflation is taking off. and rising. And yet you look at the actual numbers and it doesn't seem to tell the same story. So which one is the real story?
It's actually both. Inflation has been relatively stable, thankfully, year over year, but we're also starting to see signs of acceleration from the tariffs. And just as important, due to those tariffs, the economy shrank by half a percentage point last quarter. That's not good news, and in about 2 weeks, we're going to see what happened in the second quarter. My fingers are crossed for a good report, but we'll see. It's possible we will, in fact, enter a recession. So inflation this month was okay. Next month will likely be okay. I'm curious to see what August's data is going to look like, especially if the president goes through with the
Liberation
Day tariffs.
Well, am I right that in a recession, would we expect inflation to drop because the economy is starting to shrink?
Well, we did have a 15-year experience with stagflation, so you can have both. You can have growth and high inflation.
I don't really want to think about it. And I was a kid when, well, you're talking about Carter, during Carter's time?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then extending a bit into the 80s. So how do we tell how much of this is good news and how much is going to be bad news? What's your read?
Well, right now we've seen manufacturing contract for 4 months in a row. And a lot of that is both from anticipating tariffs and now that they're beginning to phase in also the effects of the tariffs. Because most of what we import, between 55 and 60%, isn't consumer goods. It's inputs that American businesses use, whether it's manufacturing, raw materials, components of machinery, those sorts of things. And those take time to trickle through supply chains and affect consumer prices, which we saw today with the CPI. So that is still phasing in as we speak.
By the way, every time I see oil prices go down, within a day or so, somebody says, oil prices are down. Why isn't the price at the pump down? I said, because it takes a while to get there. So that's the effect we're seeing where the imported goods haven't yet risen or the goods we're seeing haven't yet risen, but they're going to rise because the manufacturers are allowing their prices to rise as those inputs start pushing the numbers up.
That's part of it. There's a lag time. Another is that we set a record level for amount of imports during the first quarter of this year. That's because companies and consumers were stockpiling goods to beat the tariffs, to get ahead of them. And as a result, we've seen a slowdown in imports since. And as companies run through that excess inventory that they got to beat the tariffs, then they're going to have to start phasing in those price increases as they have to buy new inventory and pay the tariffs for it.
Ryan Young is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Now, forgive me, Ryan, because I don't have training as an economist, but how much of this is going to be offset by American manufacturing that avoids the tariffs? And let me give you one specific example. I think it was Nissan, it might have been Toyota, that said they were planning to, I think, eliminate their second shift at a major American plant where they make their cars. And then when the tariff news came along, they said, we're not going to eliminate that second shift. We're going to keep on producing and perhaps producing more in America. How much of an offset can some of those manufacturers, not all of them, but some of them see by doing that? They just say, well, we'll sell you American-made cars instead of cars made in Japan.
It's going to be a mixed effect. As far as jobs go, it might, you know, steel tariffs will help the steel industry, for example, but they're also going to hurt the auto industry at the same time. So each tariff will help one group and hurt other groups. The total effect on jobs, it's hard to predict. That's why I'm glad to see that the labor market has been holding up under the tariffs. But as far as manufacturing output, that's already been shrinking for 4 months in a row, and I would expect that to continue, especially if we have car tariffs of $3,000 or more per car. That's going to price out a lot of families from being able to buy a car. So even if companies make them, not everyone can afford them.
Or will it cost them, unless the people are very, very brand specific about it, is that going to cause a shift, say, to I'm going to buy the car that was made, whether it's a Japanese car made in an American plant or an American car made in an American plant. How much of that, isn't that what the economist calls substitute goods? When I go to the store and say steak is too expensive, I'm going to buy chicken instead. That's that kind of shift. Will we see people shift to more American manufactured goods, whether they're Japanese cars or American cars?
What you'll see is people shifting to used cars instead. And a lot of times, I mean, nationality doesn't have a lot to do with used car purchases, but
no.
When you see a lot of families shifting over from new to used cars, You know, that supply is fixed. And so when you have more people crowding into that fixed size market, used car prices are going to go up too, even though there's no tariff. So that's going to be another problem spot for a lot of families.
Any other spots that you're seeing that they're going to have a particular effect that people are going to notice?
Construction, I see, could be problematic. Lumber tariffs, steel tariffs, copper tariffs for wiring and for plumbing. And in fact, in this month's report that just came out, one of the biggest components of that rise was construction. So new housing, that's going to affect people's mortgages and rents, new businesses starting up and needing new facilities. That's going to be costing more.
Ryan, you just hit one of my favorite issues, and my audience knows this, so they put up with me when I do this. Why does America, well, they do. They're very tolerant of me. That's the one kind of tolerance I actually like, is they're tolerant of me asking stupid questions. Why does America, a country with 200 million acres of trees, import 28% of its lumber?
That's a really good question. Part of it has to do with the species of trees. Not every tree grows in America in abundance. A lot of it has to do with regulatory restrictions. Lumber companies are smart enough not to cannibalize their own business and over-harvest. And I don't think regulators get that quite enough. And a lot of it just has to do with prices. Sometimes, depending on labor costs and other costs, it might be cheaper to cut down the same kind of tree in South America or in Asia and then ship it over than to pay American labor prices. So prices, regulations, and also species have a lot to do with it.
Although an awful lot of that 28% is coming from Canada, which means it's likely to be very similar species, if not the same species, and is coming in from not that far away. It's not coming in from the other side of the planet. I mean, if you build your house out of mahogany, Ryan, I admire you and I'm envious, but my house is built out of Doug fir. So I'm just curious, could we see a shift there where American sawmills will say, hey, if the Canadian stuff costs 25% more, we should be able to sell a whole bunch of lumber and stop buying the Canuck lumber?
We might, but President Biden himself doubled the tariffs we were already charging on Canadian lumber. So that's already been in effect. I don't know if President Trump has further increased the Biden tariffs or not, but they have a similar mindset on that with the same goal in mind, to use more American lumber. And the effect so far has been indeterminate because, you know, if your competitor's not going to undercut you, you can get away with raising your prices. So American producers are raising their prices because it's harder to undercut them now.
You know, it's funny that Biden jacked up Chinese tariffs and also blocked off a bunch of anti-tariff routes to try to sneak Chinese stuff in. He did that less than a year ago, and the cartel media didn't go crazy. But now that it's Trump, they do. Can you explain that effect?
Well, the last thing I would expect from any politician is consistency. And while Biden is overall a protectionist, between just the media giving him a pass, he's also not consistent in his policy. He did raise tariffs. And he did other measures to disadvantage American businesses. So just don't expect consistency.
No. And of course, I may not be able to blame Joe. Maybe it was just a staffer with an auto pen that made it happen. Who knows? It could be either one. That's Ryan Young. He's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, it's always a pleasure. Back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists, Oregon Medical Centers. And our ex-poll today, should Northwest Utilities ask customers to voluntarily not use electric power to avoid blackouts? My answer to that is no. The ex-poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Straight to the prosperous community of Kenmore and Alma, who's usually a naysayer. Alma, welcome to the program.
Hi there, my friend. I'm so glad that you let me in as a naysayer. But I have to say this, my friend. For one thing, with the poll, I believe we should cut back, you know, in preserve energy. But now, I just want to ask you, who is the president of the United States? It's not Joe Biden.
Donald John Trump.
You guys, huh?
Donald John Trump is the president of the United States. You asked me a question. I answered it.
Why you guys keep hitting on Trump? Biden did this, Biden that, Biden that. It's Trump, and it's the, what is that? And it's the, what's the guy that they're talking about? That,
Alma, there is a little carryover from previous administrations. I remember when Barack Hussein Obama, do you remember him? You may have voted for him.
That was the best president you'll ever get.
Okay, and Barack Hussein Obama spent, I remember for 4 years, he blamed his predecessor for everything bad that happened. And I kept wondering, it might be one thing to blame your predecessor for 6 months or 8 months or a year, maybe a year and a half at most. Obama did it for 4 solid years. And then only after he got elected a second time did he stop blaming George W. And W is probably... But why do we talk about the previous president? Let me ask you this, Alma. Do you think that Donald Trump's tariffs on China are a good idea?
Trump's tariffs on anybody is a bad idea.
Okay, if so hold on, Alma. Alma, last September...
Laura, you should let me answer.
Okay.
Those tariffs are a bad idea, period. We know that. I've been reading, because a lot of stuff you don't understand, and I know... We're paying the tariffs, the ones in the United States, we're going to end up paying it at the end of the day.
Now, well, let me ask you then, Alma. 10 months ago, in September of last year, Joe Biden jacked up the tariffs on China, some of them up by 100%. Was it a bad idea then?
Well, he had a reason.
Oh, so Joe Biden is the economic genius who knows when and how to apply tariffs, and Donald Trump is the dummy who doesn't have a good reason for tariffs? Is that your view of it, Alma?
Listen, Lars, why are you telling the truth? Trump is the most ignorant president we ever had. You can put a 12th grader in there and they'll do better than Trump. Have you listened to him on the trail and explain things? Now, I'm not a genius.
Alma, I'm curious. So Trump is a dummy. Joe Biden is brilliant. Can you tell me, other than serving at the public trough for the last 50 years, what Joe Biden has done that is an accomplishment you could name?
Oh, my God, I wish I could just have him in line. He has millions of companies. Can you tell me really what Trump has accomplished?
Yes. Donald Trump inherited money as a young man from his dad, arguments about whether it was 20 million or 30 million bucks. Do you think it's difficult to turn 20 or 30 million bucks into a couple of billion dollars?
If you're doing it at the public's defamation.
What did Donald Trump do as a young man when he inherited that money and turned? Nothing. Most people would take 20 million and turn it into 10 million or 5 million very quickly. Most people who inherit money do not turn it into billions. He did. So tell me what he did at the public detriment.
He cheated the public. But I'm going to tell you this. And you
How did he cheat the public? Yep, he provided housing. He invested in businesses. He employed people. He paid contractors. What was the cheat?
And none of them worked. He cheated with the colleges.
None of it worked, but he made billions of dollars? How do you explain that, Alma?
He had to pay $25 million because it was all false. Everything Donald Trump has done is a lie, and always will be a lie.
Then how did, if everything he did was false and a failure, how did he turn, even if you accept that he inherited 20 or 30 or $40 million from his dad, how do you turn that into a few billion dollars without knowing something about business?
He didn't know nothing. He had somebody, people around him, just like he got people around him right now that's running the country.
Okay, that's fine. We've dealt with Trump. Now let me ask you about Joe Biden. Do you think that Joe Biden was actually running the White House for the last 4 years up to January 20?
Yes, he had a lot of sense. He had intelligence. Trump has no intelligence.
Then why did he allow his staff to sign documents without his knowledge, which he admitted to the New York Times this last weekend?
Because Because he, like I told you, he has no knowledge of what's going on, Lord. And I love you, Lord, but you know that man has no knowledge of what's going on.
Outside of his time in the Senate, the vice presidency, and the presidency, can you tell me one major accomplishment of Joe Biden?
Oh, my God, I have many accomplishments.
What are they?
I can't just
give me the biggest and best one real quick.
I'm coming back, Lord.
Give me something really big that Joe Biden managed to accomplish. Drug dealer's son, felon's son. I mean, Alma, thank you very much. You're a great naysayer. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.